Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Snap judgment!
When I was a kid, I'd mess up, whatever it was, but I'd say, I'm sorry. And whether the other person accepted my apology or not, I felt better. Like it was a magic wand. And it took me a long, long while to understand that my saying sorry, even if I meant it, was just not enough. Well, today, on Snap Judgment, we proudly present Aftermath. Amazing stories from real people after the very bad thing. My name is Glenn Washington. Thank the universe that most of us never get what we truly deserve when you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now we begin knowing that there are mysteries that have no solution, but there are mysteries that we feel we've got to solve for the good of our own conscience. Take, for example, the mystery behind the Vukovar massacre. In eastern Croatia, a small town is called Vukovar. It's where our next story begins. And in this town, during the Yugoslav War in the early 1990s, some 200 people who had been hiding out in a hospital disappeared. Sensitive listeners should know this story does contain graphic imagery. Snap judgment.
5 years after those people disappeared, on a late summer morning, some 15 investigators drove out to the quiet Croatian countryside, to Vukovar. There, they walked through a wooded ravine to a fenced-off plot of land, about the size of a football field. The land was cleared of trees and bushes and surrounded by UN soldiers.
It is just a piece of land. And somebody is telling you that underneath of this, there is a 200 plus dead bodies.
The investigators took off their slacks and button-downs and changed into navy single-use jumpsuits. They grabbed their picks and shovels and stepped onto a grassy mound. And for a whole day, they chipped away at the earth. There were whispers, doubts that this was the right spot, concerns they'd be digging for days, just making holes in the ground. But mostly, they worked in silence, digging for proof, evidence that something had happened here.
So we started to remove the soil of the ground, and then what we saw underneath was a completely different story.
This way, just roll him over. Just roll him here.
And of course, the first thing that hits you is the smell. Decaying bodies, and if I could explain it, I wouldn't to you, because it's something you don't need to know.
It's very difficult to explain that. It's like a sweet, very unpleasant smell of decomposition that gets under your skin. It gets in your clothes. You can't wash it. When we found the first body, I remember that, you know, it was a fully skeletonized body. There was a skull and the hands and the legs. When we exposed the grave, millions of flies came on us. Flies everywhere.
Remember, there was over 200 bodies in this grave. They have to clean them off. They have to look for bullet holes. They have to look for knife marks. Whatever it was that would help them decide, A, how they were killed, and B, their identity.
The team looking for bodies in Vukovar came from all over the world. Kevin Curtis came from England, where he had been working as a cop.
I didn't have a good idea of what was going to happen exactly, because I'd never been in a war situation before.
Vlad Zuro's from the Czech Republic, where he was a cop too. The first time he heard about Vukovar, he was recovering from appendicitis, stuck in bed, when all he could do was watch TV. And on the screen, he mostly saw news about Vukovar.
then I saw on television the video footage of destruction, and through the ruins people were coming out and they were dragging their trolleys of their belongings. And but if you don't understand what is happening there, you just need to know what is behind this.
When Vlad got the call to join an investigation of war crimes in Vukovar,
it was like a destiny. We had a purpose. I wanted to be there because we wanted to find the truth about what happened to those people.
Together, Vlad and Kevin tracked down leads across Europe. They went to Sweden, Norway, Germany, and of course, Croatia, door to door. They were writing down stories from refugees and gathering evidence that could lead them to some kind of justice. They wanted someone to answer for the Vukovar massacre.
The information, the evidence, started to appear before our eyes.
This is horrific. You know, you just can't... You can't imagine being in that sort of position.
One morning, Kevin interviewed a woman who had fled the violence in Croatia to Germany. Kevin brought juice and water to her small studio apartment. And they sat on chairs next to her bed, which was actually in the kitchen. They talked for 6 hours. When he returned the next evening to follow up, the woman had pushed the bed against the wall and squeezed a borrowed dining table into the narrow room. She set the table with 7 sets of cups and dishes.
And she said, I hope you don't mind, but I've cooked some food for us. But I also wanted to set it up for my husband and 3 sons that were killed. And it wasn't as if the whole house was littered with photographs and things of her family. It was just this one occasion. They would want to see that I was doing this, she said.
With each witness testimony, Vlad and Kevin became more and more determined to find the people responsible for the Vukovar massacre and bring them before a court of law.
We got to have closure for these people. We got to have justice for these people. And it's our job to do it, because if we don't do it, nobody else will.
But nobody wanted to arrest anybody.
For many reasons, it was very difficult for anyone to actually be arrested for these crimes. Vlad and Kevin were working for an international tribunal, the ICTY, the International Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia. So in an odd twist, the governments of neither Serbia nor Croatia nor Bosnia-Herzegovina were enthusiastic about a team of outsiders coming in and making arrests in any of these countries. Like, if 2 wrestlers in a match are both doping illegally, neither one of them wants a ref to come in and start drug testing.
If they arrested the opposite side, if Croats arrested Serbs, they could be accused why they're arresting the Serbs and not the criminals on the Croatian side. So they didn't want to do anything about it.
But Kevin, Vlad, and their small team of investigators had physical evidence and stories, people they couldn't just walk away from.
Son is gone, daughters are gone, raped. They were going to work, going to school, going for the weekend house, and all of a sudden it's all gone. Husband is gone, and then people are telling you those stories. It was bigger than us, you know. I honestly believe it was bigger than us. We just wouldn't give up.
They decided to focus their indictment efforts on a local politician. His name?
Slavko Dokmanovic.
Slavko Dokmanovic was the mayor of Vukovar when those 200 people were slaughtered.
He was radical. You know, he spread the hate.
He would go and he would kick people in the head and shout goal and not caring and laughing and joking.
So he clearly was a part of the machinery.
And when the siege of Vukovar was over, Dokmanovic and others commanded soldiers to load men who had been hiding out at a hospital into buses, to beat them, and eventually to drive them on a dirt road to a wooded ravine. At the head of the ravine, the soldiers unloaded the men and shot and killed them. Afterwards, the bodies, some 260 of them, were buried there with a bulldozer. Slavko Dokmanovich aided and abetted all this.
The local authorities were under him. Who would put him to jail? Who would put him there?
Kevin and Vlad decided they would.
So he was definitely one that we needed to indict.
The main problem was that Dokmanovich lived across the Danube River in Serbia, where he was kind of protected. International teams weren't allowed to just walk onto foreign soil and make arrests. So they came up with a plan to go to Serbia and lure Dokmanovich back across the river. They'd bring him into UN-controlled Croatia, where they could finally arrest him. But they had to keep their plan a secret from their colleagues.
Even within the office of the prosecutor, nobody else knew about it.
They called it Operation Little Flower. The plan was Kevin would go undercover as a UN investigator, looking for crimes committed against the Serbs, against Dokmanovich's people, not committed by them. This way, he'd gain Dokmanovich's trust.
Kevin is a smooth talker. You know, he know how to get people on board. He's very friendly.
I was better at talking rubbish, if you like, if I needed to.
And he was the ideal person for going there and persuading Dokmanovich to come across.
Kevin's job was to go to Dokmanovich's house and convince Dokmanovich to come back with him to a place Dokmanovich knew he ran the risk of getting arrested.
Everybody thought we were crazy. Everybody thought that it would not work.
Kevin and Vlad were really nervous. If Serbs found out about the plan, they could be arrested as soon as they crossed the border.
I mean, we risked being attacked. We risked being ambushed at his house. We know what we believed he'd been involved in, which was the murder of 260 people. So what's another one or two?
Vlad and Kevin decided to split up. Vlad flew undercover into Serbia. He would be Kevin's lookout.
And I drove there as a tourist to Sombor, which is the place where Dokmanovich was living. And then I would pretend to be a tourist.
Meanwhile, Kevin drove across the Serbian border to Dokmanovich's house in a UN car, a white 4x4 Toyota.
We go across the Bogojevo Bridge. We don't know what's going to happen.
Vlad sat down at a cafe about 150 yards from Dokmanovich's house. He could see Kevin's white car when Kevin and his interpreter pulled up to Dokmanovich's front gate.
Then the interpreter goes, ring the doorbell. Dokmanovich comes out and he opens the gate.
When he opened the gates, we went inside and there's two huge Rottweilers in cages right in front of me. And they were going crazy when we came in. And actually, Dokmanovich smiled and he said not to worry. He's not too tall. Graying hair, straight, with a thick, heavy moustache. And also almost, I don't think he did stoop, but he sort of gave you that impression that he was in a bit of a stoop. And we started to just chat generally about his time in Vukovar. Then his daughter came in with his granddaughter.
Then Kevin asked him about his own suffering and the plight of the Serbs.
His face lit up. You know, maybe that's not a bad idea. Maybe I'd get, you know, I could do things for other Serbs as well. And you could almost see his mind working.
Does Vlad and Kevin's super secret plan play out the way they want it to? Stay tuned to hear whether or not they can convince Dokmanovich to leave his home in Serbia.
News news organizations have always relied on police sources for information. But what happens when those sources are wrong?
Local news in New York City don't really have time to check the story. They're just being told cops were intentionally poisoned at a Shake Shack. I mean, that story tells itself.
Shame it didn't fact-check itself. Join us for this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Aftermath episode. When last we left, Kevin is in Dakmanovic's house in Serbia, trying to lure him back across the border.
His face lit up, and you could almost see his mind working.
Meanwhile, Vlad was still in the cafe, drinking coffee and then a Coke, and then more coffee. His waitress was getting suspicious.
So she comes to me, and I spoke super Croatian. So I said, you know, I'm waiting for a girl here. There was this refugee lady, beautiful Serbian lady. We fell in love. And then we agreed that we are going to meet here. And so I came to Serbia, and I'm waiting for her. Yeah, yes, it's a very touching story. And then she started looking at me like, you know, what a loser.
That's when Vlad finally saw the iron gates opening.
But when I saw Kevin leaving, then I was at Spey and look at the car, and I saw that he was on his own. So Dokmanovic didn't go with him.
Dokmanovic wouldn't go to Croatia right then, but he did agree to cross the border in 2 days, on a Friday afternoon. Kevin says he ultimately convinced Dokmanovic to make the journey under the ruse that he could talk to a UN general about selling the property he'd left in Croatia. He would meet VIP escorts once he crossed the bridge over the Danube. And then, after the conversation with the general, Kevin would go with Dokmanovic back home.
I said, what about if I come at 7 then? And he said, yes, and my wife will prepare dinner for us.
Over the next 48 hours, Kevin and Vlad prepared for the arrest. And on Friday morning, they got into position near the border. A SWAT team wearing crisp white button-downs and black suits drove out to the bridge and picked up Dokmanovic, pretending to be his escorts. Kevin hid in a military trailer, and Vlad stood behind sandbags.
It was like, I don't know, 95 degrees of Fahrenheit, and then it was like a flies flying around. It was this intense heat, and the sweat was running around my back. And I was rehearsing the reading the rights.
Behind the sandbags, Vlad read the UN version of the Miranda rights over and over.
It might sound petty, but we wanted to make sure that if it's audio recorded, people actually can listen to it and understand what was being said. We were nervous because there was a last opportunity. We knew that if it's not now, it probably wouldn't happen.
On the dot of 3, we had a call from the Polish Special Forces that they'd picked him up and they were on their way with him.
It was absolutely exciting. You know, it was, we knew that, you know, we are doing something that is critically important for all of our colleagues and for the justice. And nobody believed that it could be done. And we were that close. We were that close, actually, to pull it together. But there was still the arrest, and we still didn't know how it's going to end up.
When the car pulled up to the border, another SWAT team blocked off the road, forced the convoy to stop, and pulled Dokmanovic out of the car. Dokmanovic was caught totally off guard.
And my time came. So I went down and they handcuffed him. We decided to put the black hood over his head. So he was terrified. You saw it in him. He was terrified. He was confused. It was on his, you felt it from him. Terrified because everybody was sort of pointing the machine gun at him. And then this guy comes there and starts to speak in English to him. And he doesn't understand what that guy is saying until it's being translated to Serbian for him. And I start, you know, Mr. Dokmanovich, my name is Vladimir Dzurov. I'm an investigator from the Office of the Prosecutor of the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. I remember that to the day.
Gospodin Dokmanović, ja se zovem Vladimir Dzurov, ja sam istražitelj iz Ureda tužitelja Međunarodnog krivičnog suda za bivšu Jugoslaviju.
You are charged with the grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, crimes against humanity, and violations of the laws or customs of war for your role in the beatings and killings which occurred at Ovčara Farm near Vukovar on the 20th of November 1991. Do you understand?
And then we put him in a car, in the same car that he was arrested, and then go to the airport.
To fly him to The Hague.
And it all took about 10 minutes, but it was 6 months of hard work.
The Learjet is a very small thing. He was sitting down. I went over to him. I stood in front and I grabbed hold of the top of the hood and just pulled it off him. He looked at me astonished and clearly recognized me and said in English, for the first time I'd heard him speak English, my wife has dinner for you.
You can hear Dokmanović here saying he was invited and guaranteed safety.
Because he invited me and he guaranteed me safety.
Ja za ovo ništa nisam kriv.
I'm not guilty for
what you... It's just a... The Learjet idled on the tarmac.
We were all sweating and nervous. And then all of a sudden, the pilot says, I got the clearance to take off. And then we took off and there was a silence on the plane. Nobody talked. It was kind of a relief. The pilot told us we left the airspace and was like, yes. There was nothing to stop us, you know, from bringing this guy to the The Hague. We put together an operation that nobody believed could work. It was for the first time. We managed to pull it together against the odds and against the belief of everybody that we talked to that said it wouldn't work, you know, he wouldn't come. He did come. It did work. Nobody got killed during the operation. Nobody got injured. We got him before the judges.
Dokmanović's trial lasted about a year. A year in which Vlad, Kevin, and their team testified before an international court, along with forensic pathologists, politicians, and anthropologists who had come from all over the world. Croatian survivors and family members of the massacre also told their stories.
We'd got the evidence together, we'd presented the evidence to the court, and then it was just a case of the court decision.
We believe we were successful. Everybody believed.
Dokmanović was indicted for inhumane acts, cruel treatment, and murder. Kevin, Vlad, and the rest of their team were confident he'd be found guilty by the court. All that was left to do, wait for the verdict.
And it was for the first time we could take holidays. So everybody disappeared from The Hague. Everybody wanted to go somewhere, and I promised to my family I will take them to Italy for holidays. So we jumped in the car, we were driving from The Hague across the Alps. The telephone, my mobile phone rings. So I tried to pick it, and I drop it on the floor of the car. So I said, I better stop. So I pull over, found the phone, and I see it was Clint. So I call him back, and my first words were, so how many years? Because I expected that they announced the verdict. And he says, Dokmanović is dead. And I said, what are you saying? He said, you know, he committed suicide. And I said, are you serious? He said, yes. You know, he killed himself. I was like, damn it. You know, all the work that we put into it, on one side, but also all the hopes of those people that they finally could see somebody responsible for killing of their loved ones. And he was dead. Why I did it was because I wanted to see him in the court of law where people can point finger at him and say, you, mayor of Vukovar, your responsibility was to protect the people, but you chose to beat them and allow them to be killed.
Why is the punishment of suicide not enough?
You need conviction for closure for the families that survived. And there is, I've heard since, there's no shame on his family because he was never convicted, which sounds odd, I know, but...
Mm. I guess for me, it's whether or not he committed suicide or if he went to jail, the families are still in the same place, so...
No, they're not. They're not in the same place. I spoke to many witnesses who said, you will never get the perpetrators for this. And, you know, they were talking about from the trigger pullers to the highest levels. And I said, we will. You know, we will get the perpetrators for this. And you've only got to think about if somebody did something horrible to a member of your family, what do you want? Do you want them dead or do you want them convicted of something?
In the years following Dokmanovich's suicide, Vlad and Kevin's team indicted 14 people from the region. About half of them went to prison for war crimes. Special thanks to Julian Bourgeois, who introduced us to this story. And thanks so much to Vladimir Zurov and Kevin Curtis for sharing their memories with The Snap. There is so much more to this investigation than you heard here. If you want to know more, Vlad is writing a book. It's called The Investigator. It will be released this coming November. The original score was created by Renzo Gorio for that story. It was produced by Adiza Egan, Liz Mack, and Shayna Sheely. This is the end of the episode, but the story never ends. If you missed even a moment of Snap Judgment storytelling, find it right now on our podcast, snapjudgment.org. And even though this is not the news, this has never been the news, this will never be the news, this is WNYC.